wonderful Wizard of Oz. Well, here he is, the Wizard of Wiz, if ever a Wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a Wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz has won. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the land of Oz. This is the 19th edition of The Wizards of Money, and it is entitled The Education Sweepstakes. In this, the 19th edition of The Wizards of Money, we're going to take a look at the funding of education and the rise of the slot machine. With more federal dollars being diverted to overseas conquest and the US states experiencing a severe budget crisis, some things have to suffer. And one of those somethings happens to be education. Never mind, say some states, let's just get those lotto balls rolling and the slot machines ringing.
The next drawing is Lucky for Life. Lucky for Life with 21 ways for you to win. See your lottery retailer for details. Washington Lottery proceeds support Washington Education and the State General Fund.
Ladies and gentlemen, the governor of the state of Maryland, Governor Robert Ehrlich.
Without that slot's revenue, there's two other options. Cuts, particularly cuts that impact people, and taxes. I choose slots.
As a conservative Republican, I believe a federal response is appropriate to a social evil only to complement state or local enforcement. But clearly, internet gambling poses such a problem. Offshore internet casinos continue to proliferate, and illegal internet gambling continues unabated, despite the fact that no state has yet authorized a virtual casino. The very nature of internet gambling defies regulation at the state or local level. Bets are electronic transactions in which no physical good or commodity need be transferred between the gambler and the casino.
Party is waiting and ready to go at the Sheraton Casino.
You're always welcome.
Come share the fun.
We get a double whammy. Not only do we provide more money to education, but we provide a product that people want and that's fun to play. I'm telling you, the players in California, people in California, are going to really enjoy playing Super Lotto Plus.
There have been a whole line of studies of lotteries since the 1970s on, finding things such as the states marketing the lotteries to poorer people, with messages such as, this is your ticket out, this is your way to success, rather than saying, we're going to give money to schools and that's your way to success, get your kids to read and write and go to college. No, they market, they say, here's your way, don't study, take a lottery ticket. Then also, they will contract for sales. They'll have a lot more sales distributions in poorer neighborhoods.
Compulsory primary and secondary education in the United States is funded mainly by state and local governments. Higher education is funded through a combination of state and federal aid programs, by some rich parents, and overwhelmingly by the educated getting into a whole lot of debt. And for those shut out of funding options in the civilian markets, education funding and job training have become the primary reasons why people joined the US military. The squeeze on state and local budgets, compounded by the diversion of federal spending to war and homeland security, seems to be turning the education system into a great big game of chance, the education sweepstakes. If you don't come to the market with accumulated wealth, even something as simple as getting good health care is a bit like winning the lottery. And so is getting a good education. Small wonder then that the lotteries and casinos the states are expanding to plug their budget holes are attracting more and more of those who can least afford to play. Without a good education, it is much harder to face the daily battle with the trickster who lies at the heart of both capitalism and the slot machines, that trickster called risk. The shifting nature of government spending is turning the economist's favorite theoretical relationship between risk and return on its head. For the markets to work efficiently, an investor should only get high returns if they are taking on lots of risk, and conversely, they should expect low returns where risk is minimal. But increasingly, certain market players can get huge returns by taking on hardly any risk, simply by playing against others facing huge risks for low or negative returns. Now, government bodies, in their desperation, seem to be making this problem worse. And sometimes they're even the ones running off with the public's money.
Why should you play keno each day? Blowing your very hard-earned pay. Winning at mass cash would be great, but you'll never win, it's not your fate. So get a job with the state. Why should you play the lottery when you can have big bucks for free? If you want T-bills and CDs, stocks and yachts, a Mercedes, get a job with the state treasury. Just help yourself to unpaid checks. What the heck? They're in a vault collecting dust. Just help yourself and you will be the best dressed employee until they make the bust. Just help yourself on the job, 'cause you can rob a ton of other people's cash. But me, I'll stick to quick picks and scratch tickets.
The constant marketing we see every day of gambling and lotteries, whether it be over the internet, the television, the radio, or even at the local store, is the stuff of genies and magic lamps rooted in hopes, dreams, and suspicions. So said a report on gambling commissioned by the government as the last century came to a close. In this edition of The Wizards of Money, we'll speak to one of the authors of this report, as well as an investment banker in Maryland, about the slot machine business, and we'll also speak to a professor at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. But first, speaking of that rascal called risk, let's delve into the history of risk and why the business of risk management is so important. Now ask yourself, what is the defining feature that lies at the heart of capitalism? To that question, many people would probably answer, it's profits, of course. But it may be more correct to say that it is risk. Profits are compensation for taking risk. In a capitalist economy, individuals with accumulated capital either spend it on something real or invest it, which really means lending it to some economic venture. When you invest your money, you're putting your capital at risk, for you might lose some or all of it. Investors are compensated for this risk-taking by the potential for profits. This potential for return provides the incentive for risk-taking, and it is this risk-taking that has led to phenomenal economic growth in market economies. One of the downsides of this system is that individuals are required to bear many of the risks of daily living themselves. The risks of devastating events like unemployment, sickness, accident, and the loss of housing. In our current economy, some of this is alleviated through government safety nets and the insurance markets, where risk can be transferred but for a price. As government safety nets shrink and more people find adequate insurance coverage prohibitively expensive, it becomes increasingly important for individuals to develop their own contingency plans. In a market economy, then, each player would do very well to understand how to manage his or her risks and how to take calculated risks. Amazingly, though, many people do not pay much attention to this ever-changing, ever-elusive beast who runs so much of our lives. Risk is sneaky. It likes to influence everything, but let something else take the blame or the credit for it. For thousands of years, much to its delight, risk evaded human scrutiny as the humans worship the sun, then the gods, then a single god, and of course, the two permanent occupiers of the human mind, fate and destiny. But over the past 1,000 years, various tools developed to measure risk and for humans to take some control of this wild beast. These capabilities are ultimately what led to our capital markets and our modern monetary system and its financing of the industrial and then the technological revolutions. Developments in mathematics and developments in finance have been inseparable since the days when merchants would use an abacus to calculate their trading gains. But perhaps the real turning point occurred somewhere along the halls of Baghdad about 1,000 years ago. While Europe was still bumbling through the Dark Ages, an Arab mathematician named Al-Khwarizmi laid the foundations for the basic arithmetic and algebra we use today, upon which most subsequent mathematical theory would later be based. And part of his motivation was quite simply practical, to facilitate trading. Imagine how things would have progressed if instead of this development, the world had stayed on the old Roman and Greek numbering systems. Then we still may be adding up these old numbers with an abacus or pebbles in the sand today. It must have been at this point that Risk was getting nervous that soon, not only would it be noticed, but that the humans might try and use it to their advantage. As Europe woke up from its dark era and the Renaissance era began, the Europeans built on these developments from the Arab mathematicians, and the equipment for dealing with risk and the mathematics of finance began to develop. Initially, probability theory was born mainly as a result of wealthy men's fascination with games of chance. Accounting theory developed in Italy and facilitated the flow of capital into business ventures. Then the mathematics behind insurance, or actuarial science, began to develop to help manage the risks of overseas trade and financing vehicles such as annuities issued by the English government to finance their budget deficits. Over the centuries, the mathematics behind trade and finance has developed as a tool to help investors take calculated risks and get capital to flow in the direction of economic development rather than catastrophic loss. Finally, the late 20th century saw the ultimate formalization of the practice of risk management, and today there are tools to help us manage the risk-return trade-off for just about any risk we can imagine. Risk has been caught and tamed for economic growth. Well, at least up until now, there's no telling what's around the corner. For a market economy to be somewhat fair in providing opportunity, all market players must know how to play and must be able to make sensible risk-return trade-off decisions. Where you have large segments of society that participate but never really learn how to play, then they will be preyed upon by the more knowledgeable players. Even more important than money itself is information about money, so said a past CEO of Citigroup a few years ago. Just as in a sports game, it's important for each player to know the rules of the market game and to learn some skills and strategies to get to their desired outcome. Also of paramount importance is to have some information on how other players are going to play the game. Deregulation in both the financial and gaming sectors over the past few decades has created a situation where the more sophisticated players can play directly against those that never even learned the rules of the game, let alone strategy. And so over the past two decades, we have seen the rapid rise of things such as predatory lending, credit cards, and the focus of this Wizards episode, lotteries, slot machines, and casinos. All of these create a transfer of wealth from the poorer to the richer, based on the knowledge gaps between the two groups. And at a time when government safety nets at the federal, state, and local levels are in pretty bad shape. Capitalist economies have tried to prepare people for a life in the market economy through their education systems. They have also tried, in varying degrees, to provide a safety net for those who do not have the ability to withstand the risks of disability, illness, unemployment, and so forth, to prevent them from being shut out of the economy. But the government funding for this safety net for handling risk and for the education system is shrinking as states face budget crises and as federal spending is increasingly diverted to war and homeland security. And more it seems that the funding gaps are to be funded by the winnings of this market game played by the skilled players against the less educated players, just as the latter becomes more tempted towards games of pure chance to change their situation.
Would you like to try a college education on your landlord's house, take the family on vacation? Eva and her blessed fund can make your dreams come true. Here's all you have to do, my friends. Write your name and your dream on a card or a pad or a ticket. Throw it high in the air and shoot Our Lady Pickett. She will change your way of life for a week or even two.
As you may have heard, most US states now face something of a budget crisis, totaling almost $100 billion in the coming year. And making matters worse, the Bush administration wanting to create more room in the federal budget for war expenses is imposing greater financial burdens on the states. Unlike the federal government, the states are bound by their own constitutions to balance the budget, meaning that they must bring in enough revenues through taxes and other means to match their expenses. And as we know from arranging our own finances, to make these two sides match, states must raise revenues or cut expenses or both. Here's Jeff Hook, an investment banker in the state of Maryland, discussing how that state is going about tackling its budget crisis.
My name is Jeff Hook. My profession is investment banker. I'm also the author of three books on corporate finance and investments. I'm a director of a nonprofit group, one of several directors of a nonprofit group called the Maryland Tax Education Foundation, the purpose of which is to educate legislators and citizens in the state of Maryland about their government and taxes. My current role in the slots controversy is to point out the profitability of a slots monopoly in the state of Maryland and to educate legislators about what it would take to get Maryland a fair deal in giving the slots monopoly to private commercial interests.
Could you talk about what's going on in Maryland in terms of state budget issues and give some background on this issue of the slot machines being introduced?
Well, Maryland, like many states, spent a lot of money and increased spending during the boom years of the 1990s. And like many other states, it can't keep up that level of spending in an economy that's going flat. So even though spending is slightly up, the revenues haven't kept pace, and as a result, the state is forecasting that it's going to have some budget deficits unless they are able to either raise taxes or cut spending. So like many states, the legislative leaders and the governor believe that the slot machines could be an attractive source of revenue. And they are embracing the idea of putting slot machines at racetracks. This is nothing new. The racetrack industry, the horse racing industry, has been proposing this idea for the last 5 years. It's an attractive way for the horse racing industry to make hundreds of millions of dollars, as been demonstrated in a couple other states where horse racing tracks have gotten monopoly licenses and slot machines, West Virginia and Delaware, which are both adjacent to Maryland.
Indeed, the states must be looking upon slot machines as a gift from heaven, and so too are the private interests that run the slots. Nowhere is the risk-return relationship more upside down than in the slot machine business. So enticing is the slot machine, it's the perfect candidate for a tax you have when you're not having a tax. They have become so charming.
more creepy, kooky, spooky fun is headed your way with the latest and hairiest addition to our Video Slots family. Introducing the Addams Family Video Slots featuring Cousin It. This hair-raising game is a 5-reel, 9-line, 45-coin nickel game with all the features you've come to expect from the Addams Family Video Slots, including rich computer animation, familiar theme music, an optional Lurch or Uncle Fester topper, and a stunning top box design that stands out in a crowd. When three good hair day symbols land on reels 1, 2, and 3 of a played line, it's time for stylish bonus game action in Cousin It's Good Hair Day Bonus. A minimum of 10 bonus spins played on all 15 lines automatically begin after the suds wash over the screen. Randomly selected bonus multipliers along the bottom of the screen lather up to 15 times the bonus win for each spin.
Hey, that's a great bonus.
And the closer you put the slots to large urban and suburban populations, the more dollars the slots generate. Jeff Hook helps us understand the economics of the slot machine business.
I'd like to talk about the economics of slot machines. First of all, who makes slot machines and how much do they cost?
Well, slot machines are made by several manufacturers. I guess one of the more popular ones is a company called International Game Technology. They supply machines to a lot of casinos and racetracks across the country. And they're publicly traded, and you can buy their shares on the New York Stock Exchange. A slot machine, the average slot machine costs around $10,000.
And what net revenue does a single slot machine generate per day after paying out winnings?
The amount of win that's paid out varies by location. I mean, most the slots in Delaware and West Virginia pay about 92%. Of the money put in them in terms of win. So if you put $100 into a slot machine in Delaware or West Virginia, on average, you're going to get $92 back. So that leaves $8 for the house. In other localities where there's more competition, the percentage might be a little higher. In Vegas, they might actually pay out 95 or 96 cents on the dollar because there's more competition. The percentage, as I said, varies at, say, between 8 and 3% of that keeps that the house keeps. Now, the revenue or the win that's generated per day after all the players are receive their share, the money that goes to the house varies as to where the machines are and what the degree of competition is. It's very important to generate the maximum amount of revenue that the machine be located in a highly populated area. I mean, clearly, if a machine is located in downtown Chicago, it's going to have a lot more business than a machine located in Helena, Montana, where nobody lives. So it's very important to maximize that the machines be located in populated areas. The second thing that affects how much revenue a machine gets per day, which is usually the statistic, it's called win per day, is what's the degree of competition. In a monopoly situation like you have in Delaware or West Virginia, the win is going to be higher on average than in a place like Las Vegas where anybody can open a slot machine parlor. So in a very highly populated area where there are monopoly characteristics, where there aren't many other competitors like suburban Chicago, you have a monopoly situation with a heck of a lot of people, the win per day is between $600 and $700 going to the house.
Based on what you're saying, it only takes a few weeks to recover the cost of the slot machine. Is that right?
Yes.
And how many is the state of Maryland proposing?
The state of Maryland is proposing 11,500 machines at 4 racetracks.
And what cut does the state get versus the private company?
Again, that varies according to some of the parameters I discussed earlier, where you are, the degree of competition, the degree of monopoly. In Las Vegas, the like the state gets a very small percentage because there's so much competition and each slot machine doesn't generate that much revenue. There, the tax might be only 8%. As you get into places like West Virginia and Delaware, which have monopoly situations, the state gets a cut of around 50%. In Maryland, they're proposing that the tax get, or the state gets, and other PRDs get 61%. And the tax say, well, that's the lowest percentage so far in the United States, but they fail to recognize that, you know, they're going to be getting a monopoly in the fourth largest metropolitan area. And the monopoly is going to be much stronger than in either Detroit or Chicago.
What would the ROE or the ROI be, return on investment, for what's left over to the private companies? What would their return be?
If they get 39% of the total revenue. Their total revenues per year, based on our calculations, will probably be around $700 million. And their operating expenses, using their own data, is approximately $350 million. So their what's called operating profit will be around $300 million or so. And from that $300 million or $350 million that they're going to get in operating profit, they have to pay off their interest expense if they borrow any money and the federal income taxes. So, you know, basically we believe that their net income could probably be something like $200 million a year. And depending on what they have to invest, we think they have to invest probably only maybe $300 or $400 million at the most to get these tracks started. Their return on investment will probably be roughly 100% a year, which is, you know, unbelievably high.
Thinking about that return, the high return expected in relation to the risk that they're undertaking, the main risk that I can think of, if you'll excuse my expression, a bums on seats risk, that you don't have enough people playing to cover your fixed expenses.
Yes.
But that, so what, every business has that risk and they don't get 100% return. So it puzzles me how you could have such a high return. I mean, to me that means that a lot of capital is going to be flowing into this type of business.
Yeah, absolutely. The returns are outrageous. You know, the only comparable business that has that kind of return is probably dealing drugs or something.
Or weapons, maybe.
Weapons, right. Yeah, you got it. So, you know, it's totally crazy. You know, when we're trying to tell the legislators and the state executives that, you know, this deal is unfair to the citizens and the taxpayers.
Bill Thompson, a professor from the state whose primary export is slot machines, helps us understand the impact of the gaming business on local communities.
I'm Bill Thompson. I'm a professor of public administration at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I study the gambling industry and all facets of public regulation of gambling and public policy concerned with gambling. I study the question of whether we should legalize a form of gambling or not. What are the benefits? What are the costs? How gambling will affect an economy, how it affects a social structure in a community.
How do you respond to people that say, well, gambling's great because it's bringing all these jobs to the community?
Right. Well, I say ask two questions and really go after the answers. Where does the money come from? Where does the money go? If the money comes from local people living within a 50-mile circle, as most casinos around the United States, the riverboats and the Indian casinos, and certainly slot machines and bars, the money comes from people living around 50 miles. That means no money is being brought into the economy because of gambling.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have to ask the question, where does the money go? Number one, you have to ask who owns the casino. If it's a riverboat, it's going to be somebody that lives far away. Because
who does own the riverboats then?
Well, if the riverboat's in St. Louis, the person owning it would be Harrah's, maybe a gambling company that's headquartered in Las Vegas. It might be Hilton or Park Place, again, a gambling company that's located in Beverly Hills or Los Angeles or Las Vegas. It'll be Caesars is in California. It'll be an outside, Caesars is now part of Park Place, but it'll be an outside company. So about 20% of the money gambled and lost goes out in profits. So, and then you say, well, what does the casino, where do the casinos buy supplies? They buy all of their slot machines in Nevada because that's the only big product we make, is we make slot machines. And a slot machine costs about $10,000. So a casino has 2,000 slot machines, that's $20 million that they send to Nevada. Well, now, when you consider all that money they're sending out and you realize they're not bringing any new money in, they are a loss for the local economy. People are gambling instead of going to movies, restaurants, instead of going shopping. So, yeah, people will get jobs in the casino, but nobody considers, well, over there somebody lost a job. Over there somebody lost a job. Over there somebody lost a job. And when you put the full equation together, you might find more people losing jobs than getting jobs.
Mm-hmm. And while the huge returns from the low-risk slot business are attracting those with degrees from the Ivy Leagues and lots of capital to invest at one end, at the other end we have the slot player who, on average, will of course lose money. That is, their expected financial return is negative. The so-called house edge on slot machines ranges from about 5% to 15% in some cases. This house edge is the proportion of money that you will lose on average if you keep pumping dollars into the slot machine. It's the pure profit cleared by the slot machine for its owners. Here's the Maryland investment banker, Jeff Hawk, talking about this guest at the other end of the slot machine.
The preponderance of people that play slot machines, you know, they tend to be older. They tend to be women. I mean, they tend to be, you know, middle class, perhaps with a shade toward lower, not really poor, but sort of lower income. But so they're older people, predominantly women, that aren't really wealthy. But, you know, I guess they see this as entertainment.
And does the state have any concerns about that?
Well, in Maryland, the state legislature is dominated by Democrats, and, you know, they often, at least a lot of these legislators, you know, indicate a high level of concern about, as do the Republicans, about unfair expenses and taxes going on the lower income. That's entirely legitimate. Somehow that argument tends to get lost in the slots debate because of the huge revenues that the state sees being applied to the budget.
And Bill Thompson talks about the national trends in this area.
In California, the governor's gotten together with the Indians, and he said, look, if I let you have lots and lots more slot machines, will you give me money? And the governor there, Gray Davis, is looking to get $1.5 billion. It won't solve his $30 billion crisis, but he sees the possibility of getting $1.5 billion out of the Indian casinos, which would be close to three times what we get from casinos and tax money in Nevada. California would be the biggest casino state in the country by far if the governor pulled it off. But he'll be pulling it off with taxes which really fly in the face of federal law. And the public won't be involved in it. It'll be a matter of the Indians wanting to expand the casino and the governor saying, yes, this will help me with my fiscal budget problems.
But the expansion is taking the form mainly of slot machines, is that right?
Indian gambling casinos, Native American casinos, being given the opportunity to have larger casinos. In California, lots more slot machines. Then in other states, lotteries want to expand into having slot machines. Racetracks want to have slot machines. Extra riverboat casinos. In Pennsylvania, that's sort of the formula is racetracks will get slot machines, and then there will be riverboat casinos. State of New York has approved slot machines for racetracks, and they've authorized Indian casinos on non-Indian lands. They're going to make the lands Indian lands, and they'll allow more casinos. So they've allowed a new casino to start in Niagara Falls, New York, and they're going to allow one in Buffalo to be run by Seneca Indian Tribe. But they'll also allow thousands of slot machines at racetracks. And it's all to get public revenue.
Well, I'd like to ask you about that because it sounds like you're saying that a lot of the push is related to slot machines and also to lotteries. And a lot of people sure. would argue that those games that don't require a whole lot of skill sure. basically become a very regressive tax.
Oh, I would agree. I would agree that these are the kinds of games that reach out to the public, and in all the formats that are being presented, whether it's California, New York, or Wisconsin, in all cases, it's gambling that will be addressed at local populations, drive-in people. It will not be addressed to tourists. And the games offered, even the racetrack, horse race betting takes a lot of skill if you really want to get into the intricacies of the wagering process. You know, if you want to do more than just bet on your favorite color horse, colors on a horse. But the slot machine involves no skill. I mean, almost no skill. And then you have video poker machines where people think they have skill because the machine says, do you want to discard your card or keep your card? So people get a sense of skill. But these games, the general public is the audience, and the games are put amongst the public or very close within an hour drive. People play these games, and then some of the people, if there's a combination of personality factors, social situation, so forth, and playing history, and the biggest thing is, the biggest factor is, does the player have a big win early? You put all those together and you get a lot more compulsive gamblers. The National Gambling Impact Study Commission, which met between 97 and 99, said the compulsive gambling rate doubles when you put the casino-type gaming, which would be the machines within 50 miles of people. So, yes, this will be a major social cost that comes along with it. Governors and the legislators that are looking at the free tax, what they consider free tax money, are not considering the compulsive gambling problem.
Has it become worse now that in the past decade or so, the credit card company has been offering credit lot more than...
That seems to be the first place people go for money. I mean, people that run out of their own money.
Mm-hmm.
They have 20 cards. They max the limits on all the different cards. The casinos have card machines where they have ATMs, but they also have credit card machines that allow quick loans. But the machine will take something like 5 to 10% of the money right off the top when it's loaned. You want $100? Okay, we'll charge you $110. Put your card in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really almost it is what I would call usurious to an extent that the law should not allow. But I'm sure these machines are legal or they wouldn't be there. Then there are ATM machines, and there's a funny thing about ATM machines. They'll charge something like a $4 charge in a casino. They'll also allow you to borrow from your credit account on your checking account, so you can go into debt $500 or so at a time on the ATM machine. But when you see an ATM machine in a casino, that machine will loan you money. The machine will not allow you to make a deposit.
No question, slots are a bad bet if you're the one putting the dollars in. But the worst odds of all, and the most regressive tax of all, meaning that it's a much higher tax for the poor than the rich, is, of course, the state lottery system. The history of lotteries is an interesting one, and perhaps longer and more volatile than you might be thinking. Recorded history shows that lotteries date back to at least the time of Julius Caesar. Around 100 BC, the Chinese created keno, and more than 1,000 years later, Europe came out of the Dark Ages, and monarchies and governments set the trend of using lotteries to fund government spending. Believe it or not, in the 1600s, the English kings ran lotteries in London to help fund early colonies in America. Later, lotteries were used by the founding fathers of America to fund the Revolutionary War. In 1776, in France, Louis XV appears to have started the trend of states having a monopoly on lotteries for reducing state budget deficits. Then in the 1700s and 1800s, in the absence of an income tax system and a Federal Reserve system, lotteries were a standard source of revenue for public and private spending. 50 US colleges and 300 schools were constructed with the help of lottery proceeds, including even Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. But these lotteries, unregulated as they were a breeding ground for corruption and fraud. State and federal governments decided to shut them down. By the end of the 19th century, lotteries were banned in most states, not to be seen again for many decades to come. During the 1960s and 70s, lotteries began sneaking their way back onto the scene, and lottery sales reached about $1 billion by 1976. In the late 1900s, multi-state lotteries emerged, and today 38 states have lotteries, and total US lottery sales are now about $40 billion and growing fast. The majority of these states use the bulk of their lottery proceeds to fund education. No doubt about it, your expected return from playing the lottery is very negative. First, the house edge, or the amount that goes into state coffers, is a whopping 50% or so, the largest house edge of any chance game. And your odds of winning the Mega Millions prize are lower than the possibility that Martians might land on your doorstep tomorrow. Of course, you wouldn't know this if you listened to the states advertising their various lottery wares.
It's the Washington Lottery drawings for Monday, March 24th, 2003. As we watch tonight's winning daily Keno numbers appear on your screen, win Mega Money playing the nation's biggest lottery game. Stop in at your local lottery retailer and pick up one or more Mega Millions tickets. Mega Millions, buy whatever you want. The current Mega Millions jackpot is $15 million. The next drawing is Lucky for Life. Lucky for Life with 21 ways for you to win. See your lottery retailer for details. Washington Lottery proceeds support Washington Education and the State General Fund.
Here's Bill Thompson on lottery advertising and the education sweepstakes.
It's another thing the politicians are not considering and governors are not considering, who out of whose pocket does the money come. The governors and the legislators think gambling money falls out of the sky as if it's falling off a tree like leaves. It's not. It's coming out of people's pockets. And we have to look at this question. There have been a whole line of studies of lotteries since the 1970s on, finding things such as the states marketing the lotteries to poorer people with messages such as, this is your ticket out, this is your way to success, rather than saying, we're going to give money to schools and that's your way to success, get your kids to read and write and go to college. No, they market, they say, here's your way, don't study, take a lottery ticket. They'll use those messages. Then also, they will contract for sales. They'll have a lot more sales distributions in poorer neighborhoods. They won't have lots of sales in nice suburban neighborhoods, in wealthy neighborhoods. Those people don't really care to buy the ticket. It's not a part of their life, whereas they will buy tickets, but the poor people will make it a part of their life. They'll get tickets every week. $600 a year would mean, goodness, $10, $12 a week on tickets. And these people are the least likely, the least able to afford the tickets. And when the government only returns half the money in prize money, you see that they are draining money out of poor communities for the benefit of the whole state, which means for the benefit of the rich as well as the poor. So it's poor people paying for services that go to everybody.
Well, in the case of Georgia, the Georgia Hope Scholarship Program, isn't the situation even more extreme than that?
It is, because the people going to college are middle class and up. The people buying the lottery tickets are middle class and down. So college educations for affluent people are being paid for by poor people. That's the wonderful, beautiful Georgia Scholarship Program that is the model for the country, and even Nevada bought the model.
In 1999, the National Gambling Impact Study Commission, put in place by the U.S. government, commissioned a study on lotteries entitled State Lotteries at the Turn of the Century. A section of that report reads as follows, quote, "Promoting lotteries does more than persuade the public that playing is a good investment. At one level, the sales job may be viewed as values education, teaching that gambling is benign or even virtuous activity that offers a desirable escape from the dreariness of work and the confines of limited means. Not only does lottery advertising endorse gambling per se, it may also endorse the dream of easy wealth that motivates most gambling. Many ads are unabashedly materialistic, with winners basking in luxury and lives transformed. Yet this is not the materialism of hard work and perseverance, but rather of genies and magic lamps rooted in hopes, dreams, and suspicions." End quote. Ironically, it is the state governments who we elect to represent us who are responsible for feeding this message of myths and magic back to us. I spoke to Philip Cook at Duke University, one of the co-authors of the National Gaming Impact Study Commission, Lottery Study, about the capital flows of the lottery.
I'm Philip Cook. I'm a professor of public policy studies at Duke University. And I do research on a variety of topics, including commercial gambling and alcohol abuse and violence.
Can you talk about the National Gambling Impact Study Commission? And I understand that it doesn't exist anymore. What was its role, and what were you involved in doing for it?
The National Gambling Impact Study Commission was created by Congress. It was a group of citizens that represented the different areas of commercial gambling, and also included some people who were critics of gambling. And they commissioned a national survey of the public to find out how much gambling people were doing. And they held a series of hearings, which was the basis for a report that they issued in 1999. And one of the things that they did was to ask Charles Klotfelder and me to advise them on state lotteries.
One of the things I think is interesting in your report, which is called State Lotteries at the Turn of the Century, is the demographic information. In particular, the education, how lottery expenditure varies by education level and also by income level. Could you talk about that?
Yes. I mean, I think that the big picture here is that about half of adults play the lottery in any given year. And most people who play the lottery spend only a few dollars on it. But there are, of course, some people who spend a great deal of money on the lottery, and it turns out that relatively small group account for most of the expenditure, and they are very important to the success or failure of the lottery business. But let me answer your question. So if you look at how participation rates relate to education and income, as we did, what we found out is that, first of all, there's really no relationship between participation and education. So people who were high school dropouts are about as likely to play as people who are college graduates. There's, on the other hand, the people with less education, if they do play, they spend more on the average. And so that you get a surprising pattern, perhaps, that the people with less education are spending more per capita than people who are college graduates. And with respect to income, what we found was that people who, well, let me say this, there's very little relationship between income and lottery participation or lottery expenditure, up through about $50,000 per year. But the average play starts to drop off after $50,000. And people who are fortunate enough to make over $100,000 a year spend about half as much as people who make less than $10,000.
And what about the relationship between high school dropouts and college graduates? How much more would a high school dropout spend on the lottery than a college graduate, say?
Yeah. Well, again, for those who play, you know, the half who play at least once over the course of a year, we found that the dropouts were averaging $700 a year, and the college graduates were averaging just $178 a year. So the dropouts are spending, you know, a good deal more, maybe about four times as much as the college graduates.
Would it be fair to say then that if you didn't have such high expenditure from the lower income groups and the lower education groups, that the lottery wouldn't work, that it wouldn't raise the revenue that the states are trying to raise?
Yeah, it's certainly true that the top 5% of players account for over half the total expenditures. So it's very concentrated. And it's particularly concentrated among groups with less income and less education. So, yes, I think it is fair to say that the success of the state lotteries owes disproportionately to the interest on the part of lower income and less educated people.
Then there is another question about lotteries and gaming in general, and that is whether cuts in the social safety nets will actually drive people further into the gambling trap. Here's Philip Cook again.
And what happened to the impact study commission? It would seem to me that there's never been a more important time to have such a commission. Does it exist anymore?
No. No, it issued its report, and as far as I know, it disbanded after that.
And so is that, you know, like we're talking about, the states are not only expanding lotteries, but many other forms of gambling. You know, what information are the states using to make this decision, or are they just lured so strongly by the dollars that will come from that they're not looking so much at that this type of research?
Well, I think that they are certainly attentive to the consulting firms that are telling them about how much money they might make, and in terms of what concerns they might have about the social problems engendered by increased gambling, that's hard to say. Often, I found that the concern is pretty much limited to pathological gambling and the possibility that there will be more people who develop a real compulsion around gambling, that's something that is going to be a problem for the state because of increased bankruptcies and so forth. The larger problem, it seemed to us, is it's just, of course, if there's a lot of gambling opportunities, then more people will spend more money than they can afford on it, and that's going to end up hurting their family, even if they don't become compulsive about it. And so that more mild set of problems seems to get very little attention.
Well, is it more mild, though, at a time when, you know, like I was saying, the safety net has shrunk itself, so yeah. It may not be as mild as it once was.
Right, and it is scary that some people are counting on winning the lottery as part of their retirement plan, or that they are trying to make up for having
lost a job or...
If you've watched any of the business and finance shows on TV lately and seen the quick picks of the wealthier players, you'll certainly notice that the gaming sector has become popular amongst the stock picks. And there is another big favourite that's emerged from the state budget crisis, and that's the student loan market players. That is, the originators of student loans and those that buy and sell student loans in the secondary market and bundle them up into neat financial securities through the securitization process, as we talked about in Wizards Part 15. In most states, the first expense item on the budget chopping block has been college education, passing more and more tuition costs onto students themselves. Consequently, the student loan business is booming. And here the major player is Sallie Mae, close friend and relative of Fannie Mae, Ginnie Mae, Freddie Mac, Farmer Mac, and that whole clan. And she's yet another one of those semi-government, semi-private, so-called government-sponsored entities we discussed in Wizards Part 15. Similar to what other members of her family do in the home loan market, Sallie Mae originates and buys a huge proportion of student loans. Banks and other financial institutions are also major players in the student loan market. Through the Federal Family Education Loan Program, private investors get nice government guarantees on the capital they invest in student loans. Here again is an example of the risk-return trade-off being all upside down. For no risk, private investors in these guaranteed loans can get a guaranteed return, while the student taking out the loan bears the risk that they won't get a job with a high enough salary to repay their skyrocketing tuition costs. As bad as all this is, when it comes to getting a good education, the ultimate risks are borne by those who, for whatever reason, don't have access to education funding in the civilian financial markets. A number of studies in recent years have demonstrated that the majority of people entering the military do so for the benefits of education funding and job training. But they go for this promising return by taking on the ultimate risk. And that's all for Wizards of Money Part 19. Note that the Wizards of Money has a website at wizardsofmoney.org where you can access the text, audio, and references for each Wizards of Money episode.